today on the Workbench, pocket-sized test equipment. We look at the Digilent Analog Discovery 2. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Workbench. I'm your host, George, KJ6VU.
And I'm Jeremy, KF7IJZ.
This episode of the Ham Radio Workbench is brought to you by Elecraft, makers of high-performance HF radios, amplifiers, and great station accessories. Check them out at elecraft.com. By Autodesk Eagle PCB Tools, the software we use to design all of our Workbench build projects. For more info and your free copy of Eagle, go to autodesk.com/eagle today. And by PowerFilm Solar, lightweight, thin, flexible solar panels. Their foldable solar panels are perfect for soda, field day, camping, or anytime you need portable power. Learn more at powerfilmsolar.com.
Good morning, Ham Radio Workbench listeners. Before we start the show, I wanted to sneak in with something that I was able to pull together after we got our recording done. As promised, our first ever listener survey is now live. We put together 10 short and sweet questions that we would like your feedback on to help determine the direction of the show in the future. Please visit survey.hamradioworkbench.com. We'll make sure to have a link to that in the show notes, and I have started tweeting about it crazily. This will basically forward you to a SurveyMonkey survey, 10 short and sweet questions, and you are done. Let's get to the show. Thank you. Welcome to the Ham Radio Workbench, your bi-weekly deep dive on technical and making topics of interest to the ham radio operator. George, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
I am fantastic. Before we get started, we have to do our standard PSA that we've been doing the last several episodes. If you have missed our tweets, our Facebook posts, or have missed the last couple of episodes, we need you to take action if you have not done so already. Many listeners have already done this. But if you did not know, Ham Radio Workbench is going to be moving off of the Ham Radio 360 feed. We are moving to our own feed. That has been online now for, gosh, George, I don't even remember, maybe up to a month?
Mm-hmm. Better part of a month.
Yeah, so we have a brand new website specific to the Ham Radio Workbench. It's at www.hamradioworkbench.com. And to subscribe to our feed to make sure that you continue to get our show, go to your favorite podcast application. We have submitted to all of the major ones. You can search for Ham Radio Workbench, iTunes, Stitcher, through Android, and be able to get there. Kale has created a nice subscription page on hamradio360.com. For people with a lot of different options. You can also, if you subscribe with a non-standard podcast player or some other way of getting our content, our feed link is hamradioworkbench.com/RSS. And that will get you the feed for all of our content, both of our episodes. And as we start to do standard blog posts, those would be available there as well. In addition to the new feed and the new website, we also have a new Twitter account for the show, which is Ham Workbench, at Ham Workbench. And then finally, if you want to get in touch with us, we have a new email address as well. And that email address is workbench@hamradioworkbench.com. All of that information, as usual, will be in the show notes. So please take a moment. If it's convenient now, go ahead and pause the show, hop on into your podcast app, search for us, and subscribe to that new feed to make sure you do not miss future episodes. This is the next to last episode that will appear on the Ham Radio 360 feed. We have one more show in January after this, and after that, Ham Radio Workbench will only be available on the Ham Radio Workbench feed.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, but it's important. If you like us, it's important.
Well, and if you don't, it's important.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is for folks who want to only get content from Ham Radio 360, now that Kale is back, which we'll talk about here in a moment, you know, this allows you to subscribe to the feeds to get the content you want without having to get all of everything every week. And also, the third show under the Ham Radio 360 umbrella is the Field Radio Podcast, which you can also subscribe to in your favorite podcast app.
Yeah, it's nice to see Kale coming back and doing not one, not two, but three show drops in the same week.
On one day, even.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for those of you who may have missed it, who are now subscribed only to the Ham Radio Workbench, Kale is back. He has released three episodes for the month of January. The first episode kind of covers the direction of the show, how he's changing the format, reinforcing the changes we've made to the feed. And then the other two shows are interesting because Kale interviews the two brothers who are behind the Faraday RF radio project. So one of the episodes is kind of a little bit about their background, how they got into amateur radio. And then the second episode does a more of a deep dive on Faraday RF and what that is.
It was pretty interesting. And my mind was kind of racing back and forth between, I think I know what they said, and I'm not sure what I'd use it for. And, oh, here's an idea. And then I went and checked out the website. It's interesting. I'm not 100% sure what to make of it. So I want to go back and look at it again.
So on top of that, you know, speaking of podcasts and things, I have to give two shout outs tonight. So two very good friends of the show, where I've actually been featured in other places around the internet, this week.
And who is that?
So first of all, Kenneth Finnegan, W6KWF, at KWF on Twitter. Kenneth has been with us for several shows talking about different topics on Ham Radio 360. He did a couple of deep dives on APRS. Kenneth is a very, very, very good resource and a very good explainer of complex topics. He was invited to a talk at Supply Frame to basically talk about amateur radio and the Internet of Things. That talk was recorded and posted on YouTube, and there will be a link to that talk in the show notes. It's about, I think, 40, 45 minutes long. So that was cool.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Yes. I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, so I actually knew about that one because I had seen Supply Frame tweet about it ahead of time. But then today, I ran into a second one, excuse me, that I was not aware of. As I was driving home tonight, I pulled up my podcast app on my iPhone, and one of the podcasts that I enjoy listening to, which we've discussed a few times on the show, is a podcast called Embedded.fm. It is a show mostly about embedded systems and topics around embedded systems. I've linked to a few specific episodes of interest. But I looked down, and the guest this evening was Nick Karchukas, which is another friend of our show. Nick, or at Exploding Lemur on Twitter, was one of, along with Kenneth, actually, and Smitty, they were responsible for sending me my BitX 40. But Nick was on Embedded today to discuss information security topics that are things to keep in mind for folks who are pretty much doing any technological thing online, and then, of course, the usual embedded bend. So I will also have a link to that episode. It is episode 229. If you are interested in electronics, I don't often know half of what they're talking about, but I have learned a lot of really interesting things, and I enjoy the show, and that is the Embedded FM podcast.
Well, and if nothing else, you've picked up a lot of cocktail conversation.
Yes, yes. I can fake it with the best of them. Of course, they say fake it till you make it.
So I think, isn't Nick an InfoSec professional? Isn't that what he does for a living?
Yes, he is. And that's what made him an excellent guest on their show to cover that topic.
I'll have to check that out.
All right. So yeah, those are some of the things that, you know, as far as ham radio media in different places other than just here, I just wanted to make sure we shared that. One other thing I thought I'd mention that's kind of newsy tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a new amateur radio satellite in orbit that I think has been in orbit at this point for, as we're recording this, like 24, 26 hours. So a new AMSAT satellite is up. It is Fox 1 Delta, also known as Oscar 92. Have you heard about this?
No, I don't know anything about it.
So, I mean, it's another amateur radio satellite. Currently, it is in its... I know nothing about satellites, so I'll call it a shakedown period. So over the next couple weeks, they're verifying telemetry, verifying that all the systems on board the CubeSat have come up. They're going to be doing a lot of tests and are asking amateurs, of course, even if the transponder, that may be the wrong word, I'll call it the repeater, even though I know that's the wrong word. But the ability to communicate and have QSOs with other amateurs, they're asking not to use it until they give the all clear, because they are still conducting tests to ensure that everything is functioning properly. So I have put a link in the show notes to the press release post about that satellite going up, as well as a link to the telemetry page. What's kind of cool about this is the telemetry is a lot of it is crowdsourced from across the planet.
You mean that there's ground stations that people set up and then receive that data and then pipe it back to some central server?
Yep, they sure do. There's an application, I believe, called FoxTelem, which I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes for. But this application basically can either take baseband audio from a radio receiver, or it can take, I think there are a few SDR dongles that it actually can control directly, but it will basically receive the signal, decode the frames, and then allow you to see them locally, and then also upload them back to AMSAT.
Oh, that sounds pretty fun.
You know, actually, if I'm not mistaken, at Dayton last year, didn't you interview an organization that was kind of working on building accessible satellite ground station equipment?
Yes, I did. I don't recall the team, but yes, they were doing an open SatNogs? Source.
Was that?
Yes, SatNogs. That's correct. That's right.
What were they doing?
They were doing a ground station, sort of similar to what you're suggesting here. It was kind of like a ground station for receiving telemetry, and I think aggregating that into a central repository somewhere. And I'm not sure if it was for AMSAT satellites or what exactly they were doing, but something along that those lines.
All right. Well, we will make sure to link that in the show notes.
Yeah. SatNog, Satellite Network Open Ground Station.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah. So, yeah, interesting. Nice guys, like really smart, nice guys to talk to. Check it out, satnogs.org.
All right. So, George, what is on your workbench this week?
Oh, the same things were on the workbench 2 weeks ago. Plus a few things. I started messing around with my Hakko soldering irons, so now I can officially do a comparison between the FX 888 and the FX 951. So I got the 951 to do SMD work, and then decided that it'd be nice to have a second one for bigger through hole stuff without having to change tips and all that stuff. So I thought, well, I'll get the 888 for that. And initial impression is that the quality of the 888 is good. The 951 is better. And the big disappointment is that the pencil cables that plug into the stations use a different connector. So the 888 uses a 5-pin DIN, and the 951 uses a 7-pin or 8-pin DIN, and you can't swap the pencils between them.
Yeah, but I think that implies to me that there is more signaling going on with the pencil for the 951 than the 888.
Yeah, at least two or three, because they have more pins. So yeah, there's more going on there. The other thing is my impression of the 888 pencil that it came with is that it's okay, but it's kind of like the metal's kind of like a nickel, you know, like okay quality material. And if you never had a soldering iron in your life and you got the 888, you'd be happy. But playing with the 951, I think it's a better device, at least, you know, better build quality, better material in that sense. But, they're both look pretty good. I think for ham use, it'd be a toss, frankly. I don't think you need the features of the 951 for, you know, 2.5 times the price.
Well, I mean, in all fairness, the way that the heating works in the 951, the heating element is much larger. If I remember correctly, the heating element is actually integrated with the tips for the 951. So the tips are also not compatible. Am I remembering that correctly?
The tip and the heating element is sort of like one thing with the 951. And whereas with the 888, it's more of the like the Weller WTCP style, where you've got a heating element in the pencil and then the tips slip over it. So when you change the tips, you're just changing the metal part at the end, like a Weller.
Yep.
So, you know, I think that the net of it all is if you're going to buy 10 things for your workbench and one of them's a soldering iron, I would get the 888. You don't need the fancier one. And if you got nothing else better to spend your money on, then get the 951.
Well, unless you're the type of person who might leave your soldering iron turned on for 2 weeks. Because the 951 does have an auto shut off.
That's an excellent suggestion. Yes.
Of course, though. If you, well, I mean, in all fairness and deference to your general preference for Weller, I think the WES-51 also has an auto shut off, and it's not much more expensive than an FX-888 Delta.
Yeah, that's true. At this point, by the way, if I were going to set up a bench and budget was not a major consideration, just a minor consideration, and I was only going to get one iron, I would get the 951 over a Weller at this point. So I'm kind of moving in the Hakko direction. You know, Weller still makes really great soldering irons, and I wouldn't have any problem using them. But if I had to pick one from scratch, I kind of like the 951 the best.
Well, and I mean, with the coloring of it, you'll never lose it on your workbench.
You have to wear sunglasses. You know, I think that was one of the first turnoffs, because the thing is this bright blue, electric blue and yellow, and you look at it and think, man, it looks like a toy. But, you know, it's a really decent iron. I think that's just their style.
Well, cool.
Yeah, so that was good. More to be commented about that. I must say, by the way, it's a royal pain to figure out what the tips are that work with the different pencils that work with the different stations. So they really don't make it easy for you to figure all that out. And you wouldn't think it'd be that hard to communicate all of it, but that's a little complicated. But once you get past that, it's pretty good. So next big thing is the antenna relay project. So it's done in the can. The final design is done. The first decent version of firmware is done, and I think we're ready to go make a stack of boards.
Well, that's awesome.
It is, and I sent a assembled unit over to Birik, K6BEZ, who was able to put it on a network analyzer and get some specs for us. So the original design spec for this was to make it an HF remotely controlled antenna switching relay board. So single pole, four throw switch built out of latching relays. And the goal was just to make it work well at HF. And of course, you know, hopefully better, but that was the requirement. So the measurement off the VNA shows the insertion loss up to 30 megahertz is less than 0.1 dB, which is really good. So negligible insertion loss. In fact, what you would expect to see through a connector. So HF performance should be excellent. At 50 megahertz, at the 6 meter band, we saw about 0.2 dB of insertion loss, which is perfectly fine. That's quite acceptable. Now, beyond that, it starts to climb. At 2 meters, we have about 0.8 dB of insertion loss, which is more than I would like. So it's really not designed for 2 meters, but it would work okay at 2 meters. Certainly, from all practical purposes, if you have multiple 2 meter radios, like a, you know, talking to a repeater and that sort of thing, you'll never notice an eighth of, you know, 0.8 of a dB. But, you know, it could have been better with fancier relays. And then at UHF, it really kind of falls off the cliff. So at 440, it has about 5 dB of insertion loss, which is really unacceptable. So I would say, in a pinch, you could use it on UHF if you're going to talk to a strong signal, like to a repeater station, and it would be okay. But I don't at all recommend it for UHF from a performance point of view. It's not designed for that, and really doesn't perform very well at UHF.
I mean, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, to really characterize how poorly it performs. So if you put 50 watts in on UHF, you're going to get maybe about 13 to 14 your effective power out. I mean, that's what you're losing in about 5 dB.
And you're going to heat up the board.
Yeah.
The process of doing it. So I really wouldn't recommend it for UHF. So for HF and 6 meters, it's great. For 2 meters, it's okay, not great. And I wouldn't use it at UHF. So it met all the design requirements and then some.
So that's great. That was the first spec we looked at. The second spec we looked at was the isolation. And what isolation refers to is if I have a signal on, let's say, position A, how much leakage is there over to position B? So, you know, you think about in a DC circuit with like a battery voltage, then you have an enormous isolation. You're not going to induce any DC voltage on the other trace. But in RF, you know, you could couple the RF to the adjacent traces. So that was an important measurement. So it looks like we're getting better than about 40 dB of isolation between the channels.
All right,
so what that means is,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so what does that mean in practical terms?
It means it's good. The bottom line is 40 dB of isolation through the switch is perfectly fine. If you ran 100 watts in channel one, then the signal in channel two would be 40 dB down. So 40 dB down from 100 watts. So 10 dB down is 10 watts. 10 dB down is 1 watt. 10 dB down is 0.1 watts. Another 10 dB down is 0.01 watts. So you're looking at, you know, milliwatts of energy potentially. And it's actually better than that. But so very little signal will be on the adjacent channel. So so the isolation is fine. So considering that, you know, we're trying to make this good and good performance, but not break the bank in terms of fancy components and design, it came out fine. So I think we're good to go. And we're going to go make a pile of boards, and we still have to figure out how much of this is going to be partial kits or full kits and all that stuff. And we can figure that out over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, it'll take us a few weeks to get a stack of boards back. So if you're interested in getting a board, then you know, be listening to the show here or look for posts on the Facebook page and the website, and we'll let you all know
and
what
Twitter.
Happens when they're available.
And Twitter.
And 40 CW at 70-30 megahertz.
No, we can't do that.
I can do that.
Well, no, that would definitely fall under pecuniary interest. Oh,
okay.
Yes. So, I do have a question that is, you know, we take some things for granted as far as like we talk about a network analyzer and Barrick doing all these characterizations. But one of the things I've always wondered, I mean, these ratings are given in dB, right? This isn't, they're not given in absolute power values. And I'm assuming that the vector network analyzer that he used didn't load these up at 100 watts.
Right.
So is it generally speaking that when you're characterizing this stuff that, like, so for instance, the insertion loss, we know that insertion loss is frequency dependent. I mean, that's very clear that, you know, things get, things escalate really quickly as you approach UHF. But is there a difference between measuring it with whatever power level the instrument is using versus 100 watts? I mean, are any of these, you know, attenuation or insertion loss values or the isolation values impacted by the power through the device under test?
Generally, no. So if a circuit has, let's say, 0.2 dB insertion loss, that will be the case at a milliwatt. That'll be the case at 10 watts. Now, there's probably some effect, like at a much higher power, there's probably more heat being dissipated, and the heat may cause a change in the material, like an increased resistance or some other thing that may happen. And that could have some, you know, effect, but it's kind of second order. So for all practical purposes, you could pretty much consider the dB measurements to be without regard to how much absolute power is in there. And I'm sure at the extremes, there probably is some difference, but it's really not
a
consideration.
In terms of characterizing, we're good.
Yes. Now, if you're from a practical point of view too, if you're, let's say you're building an amplifier and say, I've got a 10 dB amplifier, and that amplifier will be designed only to amplify within a certain range. So, you know, you're only going to build an amplifier to go from 1 milliwatt to a watt, or to go from 100 watts to 1,000 watts. You're not going to build an amplifier that's going to be able to take absolutely anything and make it 10 dB more. So I think those secondary effects are kind of compensated by the fact that amplification measurement in dB is for the desired operating parameters of the device.
Okay. Well, cool.
Yeah, but in theory, you know, like think about an antenna. If I have a 2 meter vertical antenna that has 6 dBi of gain, so if I put in a watt, then I'm going to get 4 watts dBi of equivalent effective power. If I put in 100 watts, I'm going to get 400 watts of equivalent relative power output. So that would hold.
Okay. Well, thank you for clearing that up. Cause I mean, that's just one of those questions that my personal intuition had kind of led me to. And like I said, this was a perfect opportunity to talk about it.
You know, there actually is a whole little sidebar that would be useful at some point. And this is very
George,
confusing.
We would never, ever, ever have a sidebar on this show.
Hour three starts now. So the whole idea of dB is very confusing to people because dB is a relative measurement. And normally when we think about measurements, we think in the absolute. So if I think that, you know, what's coming out of my wall is 120 volts, it's 120 volts. It's 120 volts. It's not, you know, relative to anything. It's 120 volts. But if I said the power of my amplifier is 10 dB, that's not an absolute measurement of anything. That's relative. So it's 10 dB more than whatever I put into it. So then you notice that there's sometimes you'll hear like dBV or dBW or dBm. Those are absolute measurements. Those are relative to a baseline number. So a very common dB reference that you'll hear in test equipment would be dBm. So if I said I'm putting out 0 dBm signal, what that actually means is I'm putting out a milliwatt, 0 dB more than a milliwatt. In other words, a milliwatt, no more than the milliwatt. So the M of dBm means milliwatt, small m. So anyway, that's something maybe we can talk about more on a show. But something good to kind of wrap your head around, because dB really refers to relative power measurement, unless you get that little third letter in there that tells you what it's referencing in the absolute.
You know, and it's if you do anything where you actually can see, so RSSI, you know what RSSI is.
Mm-hmm.
Received signal strength indicator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But a lot of RSSI, like if you deal with Wi-Fi things, RSSI is usually reported, or even your cell phone. If you, one of the things I liked about my iPhone is that instead of having bars, I actually had it in a service mode where it actually showed me the received signal strength from the towers, and that's reported in dBm, mm-hmm. which is why you would see like negative 60 or negative 90. You know, so I'll throw a link to a conversion table of dBm to power in watts, which I think is helpful. So cool. Thank you for expanding on that.
Yeah, you bet.
All right.
So I'm really excited about that whole relay project, getting off the bench and into some volume for our listeners to actually start building those projects.
Yes. So what else?
Just to wrap on the other projects, we still have the low voltage disconnect power monitor. That new version is done, and I've sent off for prototypes. So hopefully we'll get it built up, validate that it works, and have that probably in the second quarter, maybe for Dayton, if not before then. And then the other board stack project we talked about, which is the combo 3-stack boards of the repeater controller, the All-Star hotspot, and the radio adapter, those are built up and I'm testing those, but those are fairly complicated projects. So they're going to take a couple months of testing. And we talked on the last show about having them to show off, maybe have them at Dayton, but if not, have them there. For listeners, at least to show people that stuff in action. And there's another project, as if that weren't enough.
Really?
Yeah. So later in the show today, our guest, Caitlin from Digilent, is going to talk about the Analog Discovery 2, which is that little puck-sized test equipment module that has oscilloscopes and function generators and all kinds of other instruments built into it. And that little guy has a 30-pin header on the end of it. So it's a two row of 10th inch center header, and all the instrument electronics come out to those headers. And well, what could you do with that? And what popped to my mind was I can make a custom board that takes those pins and breaks them out into connectors that are more useful. So I'm making a little test fixture that I could use to test the repeater controller.
Cool.
So I'll talk about that later today when we get to that example as part of our discussion on the analog discovery. But it's really great because to test a repeater controller, you need to generate audio signals and some logic control signals, and you need an oscilloscope to measure the audio signals. And all that could be done with the AD2. It just needs a little bit of external switching logic and relays and stuff like that to make it work.
Well, actually, that may have legs to turn the AD2 or the analog discovery into a general purpose like repeater tool. Not too general purpose, because obviously, like the spectrum analysis, or sorry, the like using a spectrum analyzer with a tracking generator to tune a cavity is not going to be there. But
right. Yeah, but for everything else on the repeater controller, it's exactly what you need, because like in our multi-port repeater controllers, on the big fancy ones, we have 8 ports, and you really need this capability. But even on the small one, the little baby one we're building now, that's a 2-port controller. And, you know, you want to shove audio into one channel, simulating a receiver, and then you want to make sure the audio routes properly through all of the op amps and the digital pots and filters and, you know, whatever. And then the audio looks proper at the other end. So you need an oscilloscope to probe that. So you need both the signal generator and the oscilloscope. And one of the things you want to do is sweep it. We'll talk more about that later, but you want to be able to go through the audio spectrum to make sure you see the frequency response and there's no distortion and all that. So that little AD2 would be the perfect little piece of test equipment to do that.
Well, cool. So what else? So, is that it?
Oh man, that's I ordered a micro BitX. Even though I never built my BitX, I've moved on to the micro BitX.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I had to do that. So I'm donating my BitX 40 to Baycon. So next weekend's Baycon. We have a whole mess of great presenters. The next show is going to have a bunch of content from Baycon, so you guys will be able to listen in and hear about all the great presentations. So yeah, we have a whole mess of door prizes. ICOM is donating an ID51A+2 D-Star Handy Talkie. That's our grand prize. Elecraft is donating an XG3 signal generator. I'm going to kick in a Pactena and a BitX.
And a bunch of stuff off your old workbench.
I've got 2 bins of junk that are going to the giveaway table. So it's awesome.
You know, you mentioned the ICOM giving away the ID51 plus 2. So ICOM actually released a new handy talkie recently.
What's that? I don't think I've seen that.
So it is, this is actually a refresh of an older model. So the generation beyond, you know, we had the IC92AD handheld, which was like the flagship ICOM handheld prior to the 51. In between there, they released a handheld called the ID31, which was
an ID31.
So the ID31 was a UHF only D-Star radio that was very similar in design and capability of the 51. I don't remember if the original 31 had any of the GPS lookup of D-Star spots. I know for a fact it did not have Bluetooth capability. It did not have the data capability. It did not have the fast D-Star data, and it did not have the FM repeater lookup that the 51 plus 2 has, nor did it have the terminal mode or access point modes.
It didn't really have much of anything except basic D-Star functionality, but it was smaller.
Yes, and the thing, I think part of the reason that we may have seen this be re-released is, honestly, I think this radio is kind of attractive, if for only that, A, it's smaller, but in a world where the number of users who are accessing D-Star or DMR with a local hotspot, something like, I believe you picked up an open spot, which is, you know, a dedicated hardware all-in-one device. I have been playing with DV Megas or DV access points in the past, but if you think about it, like as far as having a nice, tiny, compact little package, this is a pretty cool option if you're only ever going to interact with D-Star through a hotspot.
Well, that's why I got it, actually. So I got it for travel because I looked at the ID51 and the 31 and I thought, well, that extra 3/4 of an inch is just way too big. That dips the scale. So I went with the ID31 because I only needed UHF to talk to the hotspot. And it works great. I've been very happy with it. So this is even better with the new version.
Yeah, I mean, it literally has every feature. So it can interact with the Android application through a cable. It has additional reflector linking capabilities. It will do the GPS search for DV and FM repeaters. DPRS, and then the new terminal mode and access point mode. But honestly, do you know what to me is the best feature about this radio for hotspot usage?
No, what's that?
Just like the 51, the lowest power level that it can go down to is a 10th of a watt.
Yeah, that's great. That thing will last forever in a 10th of a watt.
And that's more than you ever need for a hotspot. Like when I'm using my Titera MD380 here, the lowest power I can set it to is 1 watt. And honestly, that is way too much power when I'm only 20 feet away from, you know, the hotspot, to the point that I know they call them an antenna, but you've seen those little stubby antennas that are maybe an inch and a quarter long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the dummy load that I run on the radio when I'm using it in hotspot mode to try to knock the power down some more.
Well, you know, the hotspots themselves only put out ten milliwatts.
Yes. Or actually the open spot outputs 20 milliwatts.
Ooh, yeah. Big power.
So, well, that's 3 dB more.
But so your 10th of a watt on the HT is five times more power than the hotspot. So, yeah.
So,
hey, by the way, I want to ask you a question. Since we're on this open spot topic,
yes.
You had mentioned something to me the other day that I didn't know about, and I'd love to hear more about it. And that is the ability to set up your own DMR talk group / conference bridge thing. I don't know what the right term is.
Yeah. So, you caught me a little unprepared. So we're going to have to pull the documentation up. So here we go. Friend of the show, JNU, he has been, behind the scenes for 360 and us, good friend of mine. But he picked one of these things up, and he was telling me that when you get an open spot hotspot, that there was software to basically create your own private online radio network without having to connect to like DMR Mark or having to connect to Brandmeister. And so if you go to the Shark RF page and look at the open spot page, there is a line here that says create your own private radio network using our open source server application. If I click on open source server application, it takes me to a GitHub page. And under the GitHub page, there's software that you can download. Here we go. Shark RF IP connector protocol. Create your own private radio network using Shark RF devices or your own custom hardware and software. As the Shark RF IP connector protocol is open sourced, all connected and logged in clients receive the data you send to the server. And then there's a ton of documentation. This is not set up. It doesn't look like something that's set up that you're going to download a single binary and be up and running in 10 minutes. There are prerequisites for package dependencies. You actually have to compile this server yourself, and then there's a long list of configuration. But what it means is if you had a group of people using one of these open spots and you go through the hassle of configuration and running this server, you could basically, anybody who has an open spot, all connect to the server and set up your own private online conferencing that still has an RF using hamband, bridge.
So does it look like you can go point to point, or is there a way to hub? Like, would you, I know this is all very new, so I'm kind of putting you on the spot, so to speak, but do you essentially run a server system somewhere that everybody hubs to?
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me is, It looks like, because I'm seeing a picture of a dashboard. So yeah, there's centralized server server software that runs somewhere. Presumably in the OpenSpot configuration, you tell it to go talk to that server. And then on the server in the dashboard, I'm seeing that there are connected clients. And you can you know, see how they're identified and get a bunch of statistics about traffic being passed back and forth to them. And then on top of that, there's also... you know, there's a last heard section here that shows the DMR ID from the radio. And that's very similar to the DSTAR functionality, last heard, or in D Plus, or the Brandmeister last heard stuff. So it looks pretty cool. This is, you know, something I'm going to be digging into a little bit more. I need to have some more conversations with our friend to understand it, because he has done a lot of work playing with it, and he was super excited about it. But this might actually be an interesting opportunity, you know, for folks who are listeners of the show to get together that have open spots.
Yeah, that sounds great. So I've been wanting to do something like that for a long time, and whether it's a DMR connection someplace or a all-star connection or something, or maybe both. I'd love to do that.
So yeah, that's, again, stay tuned. As we continue to learn more about that, because what's nice about the OpenSpot is it seems like the company has made, I'm not going to call it open source, but there's a lot of documentations that you can experiment. In fact, one of the funny things is, if I remember correctly, one of the headlines on here is that you could actually even create your own protocol using some of the tools that they give you. Don't quote me on that, but yeah. So, I mean, it definitely bears digging into more.
In a world of too many dissimilar protocols, I think we need another one.
Oh, we probably need at least 20 more. You know, okay, so I didn't mean to go down this rabbit hole, because I haven't even gotten to my workbench yet. And
hey, what's on your workbench?
Well, we'll get to that here in a second. There's two things I wanted to cover. Yeah. So for those of you who are familiar with Northwest Digital Radio, you familiar with those guys?
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know that they ever, like, released their portable mega... the UDRX radio. Actually, it looks like they probably haven't, because the headline here is that the pilot boards have arrived from assembly. But they are doing, so they have a couple of other products. They have something called the Thumb DV, which is basically an AMBI chip on a USB dongle. And but I saw a video the other day for a new Kickstarter that they're doing that is basically a USB device that has up to 6 AMBI decoders on it, with the goal being building a single device that could actually, you know, we talked in the past about transcoding DSTAR onto DMR, and this board has all these AMBI decoders to possibly give you the ability to do that.
Interesting. So are they going to make this like an appliance where you point your DMR repeater and your DSTAR repeater to this thing and it does the transcoding automatically?
You know, that's not necessarily that clear yet. Because the other thing was, too, is Northwest Digital Radio did not design this thing. There was a ham, and I actually don't remember where he was located, but I believe somewhere in Europe. And... here it is, Kickstarter for 6-channel USB AMBI device. But they got this design from another ham, and basically went and that ham open sourced it. But they said, look, we're interested in actually producing this. Would you mind? And so they got permission to do so. But there's a little video. There is a little bit of an explanation of what it does. Again, worst host ever, because I could have been way more prepared to talk about this. But, you know, it's another thing to push the hobby forward, because the one thing that has not yet happened is we still don't have our Rosetta Stone radio that can actually talk all of the popular, you know, digital voice modes.
You know, I personally, that's not what I want. Anyway, what I really want is something off in the cloud that would allow me to bridge existing systems. I don't necessarily want a radio that does all the systems. I guess that would be fine too. But what I really want is to be able to take whatever repeater I'm on whatever network and point it to something else. Like, for instance, if I have a DMR radio and I'm talking into a DMR repeater, I'd like to be able to point that at the D-Star repeater across the country and have it sound not awful. So I don't know if that's possible, but I guess, you know, we'll find out if these guys are successful with their project.
You know, the cloud's not ham radio, right?
Well,
I'm trolling. You know, I'm trolling you.
You know, that's true if you're over 45. If you're under 45,
the cloud is
you're
everything.
You're a fossil.
Oh, yeah. I got that. But if you're under 45, the cloud is everything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
How old were you again?
A.
So yeah, those were a couple of interesting things that had come across my desk this week. I'm actually pretty sure you're going to have to fire me as co-host of the show if I don't actually get work done on a project that's not related to my kids or the house. So on my workbench right now is nothing, but for a very specific reason, and that is I am in the process of preparing for winter field day.
Oh, what you going to do?
So my club, the Ohio Valley Experimenters Club, is going to be renting a cabin at a wonderful state park a couple hours north of Cincinnati. The cabin is a nice three-story that comes with all the firewood and linens you could ever ask for. It's completely enclosed. We're taking, several of us are bringing our families with us. So, Mrs. I Judge Zombies and the harmonics will be coming along with some other kids. And basically we're going to get up there on Friday night and kind of scope the place out. None of us have been to the cabin before. The satellite views show that there are a lot of trees nearby. But basically we'll be setting up Friday evening, to make, you know, basically proof of concept of antenna placements. And then I believe the contest starts on Saturday at 2 PM, just like regular field day. And then we'll be operating we can't do the full 24 hours because of when we have to be checked out of the cabin. But I think we'll get at least like, I don't know, 2 until probably 8 AM. So
that's awesome.
It's not bad. We're going to be running. We went back and forth debating about whether we were going to set up outside or inside. We have decided that we are going to actually set up inside, which will cost us 1,500 bonus points. But we're going to be running two stations, and we're going to be doing QRP again, just like we did with actual field day this year.
You going to run the KX3?
We're going to be running two KX3s. My KX3 will be the voice, the phone KX3. The other KX3 will be set up for CW and digital modes.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to that. I am very lucky with my club. We have an amazing club, with it. It's no drama. We try to get stuff done. Everybody loves hanging out together. So, you know, just a very positive experience overall. And so it'll be good to get together and operate again, which, of course, this will be I haven't operated HF since field day last year, I don't think. So, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it.
So I'm going to try to get out. We don't have a club activity because we have our big Baycon annual conference the weekend before. So we're not going to do a club event, but I might just head off to the park for a couple hours and just see what I could do.
Yeah. Wintertime in your neck of the woods must be pretty brutal. What is it?
Yeah. It's kind of like 70? Spring in your, it's breaking 70.
Yeah.
No, it's in the 50s. It's like freezing out here.
Oh, 50s, huh? So it was in the 50s 12 hours ago, and now it's dipped into the teens.
It's in the 50s in the living room.
No, it's 70 here in the house. Although that was something else terrifying too, is so our neighborhood has, you know, it's new, but it has, you know, underground power lines, but the feeders into here, when ice and wind combine, we will almost certainly lose power because of things, that ultimately feed into our neighborhood. And, you know, tonight as the weather front kind of hit and the wind started picking up, the lights started flickering in the house. And as I put on Twitter, it's awesome because first of all, we have gas heat. So to run the furnace is relatively trivial from a load management perspective, or at least it would be if I ever installed the transfer switch for the furnace. So
sounds like you have things on your bench that are not ham related.
Yeah. Although, I mean, honestly, transfer switches and, you know, making your safe house for generator operation is probably an interesting topic. Because at the end of the day, I'd love to be able to put a transfer switch in for the whole house. But really, the thing that actually I need it for is running the furnace. And you can buy, mm-hmm. there is a transfer switch that I'm going to be honest with you is what we call a suicide plug. because it is, it's basically you run an extension cord from your generator into it. And you know, so it's like a, I think it's like a double male extension cord, and then a female socket. And you have to disconnect, the furnace from the rest of the house so that, you know, you don't backfeed onto the lines or anything.
That'd be bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that would be terrible. I mean, and that's what a transfer switch does, right? A transfer switch disconnects your house from AC service so that you can independently power your home with whatever GenSec technology you have while maintaining the very important and critical safety of the line workers out there trying to fix stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the last thing you want to do is fry one of your poor power company people.
Yes. So, yeah, Winterfield Day, it works out pretty good because I know I had to miss Winterfield Day last year because I appeared as a remote guest to BayCon. This year, they're separate weekends. So that particular weekend is the weekend that you will be putting together exciting content from BayCon, and then I'll be able to do a full debrief on the episode after that in February.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I hope you guys make a lot of contacts, and I'm curious to see how the radios do. What kind of antennas are you going to use?
We're going to try to keep it simple. We're going to basically just use three dipoles. We're going to take an 80, a 40, and a 20, the goal being running 40 and 20 during the day and 80 and 40 at night.
I should send you a Pactena.
Yeah, well, I've got one sitting here, actually. I have two of them. I have a mini and a regular. Yeah. Actually, to be honest,
hey, how's that video going?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Forgot to take the lens cap off. The last thing on my bench, though, is very pertinent to the topic we're going to be having tonight.
What's that?
Well, so we've talked about the Digilent Analog Discovery 2 many times in the past. You know, most recently you and I had a conversation that while you were traveling and you were doing some of the initial prototyping for the repeater controller, I don't remember if this was a repeater controller or the antenna switch, but you actually took your prototype with you, and with the Analog Discovery being a world of instrumentation in your bag, you were able to get some work done.
Yeah, it was super helpful. And it was so small, I wasn't really sure if I was going to take it. You know, I didn't want to take a bunch of extra junk I wasn't going to use because, you know, you're on a business trip, you got plenty to do. So it was kind of an afterthought. But it's so small that it didn't take up any room. And so I chucked it in the bag. And yeah, it was very handy to actually get some work done.
Well, that's the surprise that I have on my bench is that, you know, as we were having some conversations with them, they were kind enough to send me an Analog Discovery 2 with the BNC connector board, which we will talk about when we get in with our guest tonight, who is Caitlin from Digilent. She is the instrumentation product manager for Digilent. And we basically are going to be deep diving on everything this instrument can do and some of the common applications, and more importantly, how it can and cannot help hams. But for a general, again, it's a bench worth of gear in something slightly larger than a hockey puck.
A USB connected hockey puck.
Yes.
Well, that's awesome. You'll love it. Yeah, you will just love it. And the thing that I really liked about it, aside from the functionality, of course, it's sort of the baseline, but the software is surprisingly good and easy to use. I mean, you can just install it and run it, and it's pretty self-explanatory. And I didn't have to flip open the documentation, not that I would, but, you know, no docs required, and I could pretty much figure it all out. So it's very easy to use.
Awesome. So when we get back from the break, we will meet Caitlin from Digilent and do a deep dive on the Analog Discovery 2.
Elecraft is a world leader in high-performance HF radios, from the desktop K3S to the ultra-portable KX2 and KX3. Their reputation for performance, innovation, and support make them a top choice for contesters, DXers, and portable operations. Seamless integration with their KPA500 and new KPA1500 is a great combo, and the KX2 is my personal favorite for soda and travel. Small size, great performance, with a built-in antenna tuner and battery pack. Check them out at elecraft.com. The Workbench is sponsored by Autodesk Eagle PCB Design Tools. We use Eagle for all of our Workbench build projects. It's great for schematic capture, board layout, and you can easily generate all the files necessary to have your own PC boards fabricated. With a large parts library, great support, and a huge user community, Eagle is a great choice for the hobbyist and professional engineer alike. Download your free copy of Eagle at www.autodesk.com/eagle and start designing your next project today.
We've been in touch with Caitlin from Digilint, who is the instrumentation product manager. And of course, we have talked about Digilint in many episodes, talking about their wonderful Analog Discovery 2, which is basically an entire electronics lab in the thing, a thing kind of bigger than a few decks of cards.
Hello, Caitlin.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the Workbench.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, and thank you very much for sending me an Analog Discovery 2. I have been very jealous because George has talked about his quite a bit, everything from the work he's done with it on his bench at home to actually, I know recently you were traveling, and in the hotel room, you were finishing up one of our project designs, and you had it there for troubleshooting.
Yeah, I did. The thing is so small and compact that it's just super handy. And I didn't even know if I was going to use it, but it's small enough to toss in the bag. And sure enough, it did come in very handy.
And so tonight we are going to talk to Caitlin about the Analog Discovery 2 and about other exciting products that Digilint has. But first of all, Caitlin, tell us a little bit about Digilint, who they are and what they do.
Digilint was a company that was started by two electrical engineering professors at Washington State University. They wanted to make hardware accessible to students because it wasn't at the time they were teaching. So they created a product and then created a company around that product. And over time, we've gone more towards specializing in making affordable FPGAs and instrumentation products for developers and professionals. And we still have our educational roots.
All right. And just for those of us who are, for those of us, maybe I'm outing myself. For our listeners who may not know, what is an FPGA?
An FPGA, well, it stands for Field Programmable Gate Array, but basically it means that instead of having set hardware like a microcontroller or any sort of controller that you would put in something, you have hardware that you can program. So one day it could be a microcontroller, one day it could be a DSP. You can reprogram it on the fly.
All right, and obviously it's one of these FPGAs that is at the heart of the Analog Discovery 2, which allows it to serve so many roles.
Yep, yeah. It's a Xilinx Spartan 6 FPGA.
Okay. And so that's Digilint. Tell us a little bit, what about your role as an instrumentation product manager? What are the things that you're involved in at Digilint?
So I am involved in pretty much everything from the life, the death of a Digilint instrumentation product. So creating what products are going to be, communicating with customers, any documentation. I'm involved in all of that.
Okay, and also setting things like feature sets and capabilities?
Yep. Defining what those are going to be. I work with the engineers too, because they actually, I just discovered that they use the Digital Discovery and the Analog Discovery in their development process. So we have sort of customers in the development.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, actually, I guess considering that when you're creating a product like this, you know, the average test portfolio that you would see is, I mean, you probably have the ability to go out and get much larger, much more expensive instruments. So I think that really speaks volumes to how much trust there is in the capability and quality of your instruments.
Yep, definitely. And it's a lot of times it's just that the engineers are sitting at their desk. They don't want to go use the equipment. Someone else is using it. It's a convenience factor, definitely.
Okay, well, so George, I mean, again, we have talked about the Analog Discovery in depth, but Caitlin, I would love for you to give us the spiel. Let's start with that, because that's the product that our listeners are most likely most familiar with. What is the Analog Discovery 2, and what can you do with it?
Most simply put, I would say the Analog Discovery 2 is like the Swiss Army knife of electronics. It's what you want to have in your backpack when you're working on a project. For anything electronics, it has analog tools, digital tools for you to see inside of whatever electronics you might be working on. You can go through the list. It has an oscilloscope, waveform generator, power supplies, voltmeter, data logger, logic analyzer, pattern generator, static I/O where you can test signals, a spectrum analyzer, a network analyzer, an impedance analyzer, and a protocol analyzer. And it connects to your laptop. So you can use it on Windows, Mac, Linux computer, bring it with you, throw it in your backpack.
Okay, and so how does that interface with the computer?
So it's a little box that you plug in with a USB cable to your computer, and then you open Waveforms 2015, which is the software. And the software is totally free. It's really lightweight. It downloads and installs in less than 60 seconds, I think the last time I timed it. And then you can use that software. You open whatever tool you want to use. So you open the scope. You can open multiple tools at a time. You can open multiple windows. It also has a software development kit and a script editor. So if you need to combine multiple tools or write a custom test, or we actually just added a new feature to the oscilloscope that's really cool, where you can do filtering of the scope channel in real time.
All right. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like, why would I want to do that?
You're looking at a signal and you want to see a particular frequency range, and you don't really care about, maybe there's some noise from some part of the circuit that you don't care about. You can filter it out in software instead of having to maybe build a filter.
So maybe if you have some low frequency ripple or some high frequency noise, you can just take that out.
Yep. Yeah. And that's just one of the features. Since it's mostly software based, we add features all the time, primarily based on customer requests. So it's constantly getting more and more features.
So, I mean, effectively, this product is very similar to what we are familiar with software-defined radio, right? It's basically a hardware data capture platform, but all of the magic is really in the software.
Yep, exactly.
I would say the user magic is in the software, but the processing is really in hardware. Because in the hardware, you have the big analog-to-digital converter and the support hardware accelerators to make that operate fast enough to be useful as an instrument. There's a fair number of chips. I mean, if you actually look at the design of the AD2, there's quite a few parts in that little puck. In fact, Caitlin, I noticed that most of them are ADI parts, analog devices.
Yep.
So it looks like, was this a collaboration with you guys and ADI?
Way back when the original Analog Discovery was created, whenever we're designing a product, we work with our partners, and Analog Devices is one of our partners. So,
because it looked like just about every chip in there was an ADI chip, so I assumed that they were working with you guys on it.
Yeah, they're one of our partners that we work with frequently.
Well, very cool. So, what are some of the other test and instrumentation products that you guys offer?
The Analog Discovery was the main one that we started with, and then we came out with the Digital Discovery, which it uses the same software, but it's just created intentionally for digital developers, so like FPGA developers or microcontroller people working on microcontrollers. So it has the logic analyzer, the pattern generator, but at much higher speeds, up to 800 megasamples per second. So the other product that we have that's really unique is the OpenScope, which is similar to the Analog Discovery. It has the waveform generator, the oscilloscope, the logic analyzer. But one of the things that's really unique about it is that we've made it as open source as possible. So if someone wants to go and learn about the hardware, the firmware, the software, they can. And then the software, instead of being a desktop application, it works on mobile devices and in the browser. So if you need to debug a robot on the fly, you don't have to worry about your robot pulling off your desktop, I guess your computer, off the table.
That's an interesting product if you really want to dig into how you would build a piece of test equipment, I guess. Besides that, has anybody used that to customize it to make a special purpose test set for some application?
We've seen some people starting to work with the software interface to make, someone made, for example, a protocol analyzer in the browser, but I haven't seen anyone using the hardware yet. That would be amazing to see, though. We'd love to see that.
So I guess between the Analog Discovery and the Digital Discovery, if you're doing strictly digital stuff, then Digital Discovery is useful. But otherwise, it seems for most ham stuff, the Analog Discovery is like the perfect instrument because it's got all that stuff built into it.
Yep, it does. And then if there's a tool that you want but it doesn't have, you can use the software development kit or script editor to write custom tests.
So I think it'd be useful to maybe walk through a few of those modules specs, like the oscilloscope and the function generator and that stuff. So maybe we could dive into that in a little bit more detail. So so let's start with the scope, because the scope is kind of like the first instrument that people really want besides just a voltmeter. So so you mentioned it's got a built-in oscilloscope. There's two channels, right? It's a two-channel scope. And what's the bandwidth or the frequency of the scope, the max?
So on its own, with the flywires that it comes with, it can go up to 12 megahertz bandwidth. And with a BNC adapter, which I think you guys both have, it goes up to 30 megahertz.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say, to describe this, there is an add-on for the analog discovery too. And actually, also, does it work with the digital discovery?
The BNC adapter?
Yes.
No, the digital discovery and the analog discovery don't have the same pinout.
Okay. So, but George, do you have one of these adapter boards?
Yeah, I do. So basically, if you want to visualize what this thing looks like, it's about, Caitlin, what is it, about 3.5 inches on a side, something like that?
Yeah, 3 to 4 inches on each side, a little square, almost the same size as the analog discovery, actually.
Okay.
A little smaller.
So on the analog discovery, it's about, say, 4 inches on the side and about an inch tall, and it's kind of swoopy, so it's a little bit smaller than that. And on the back side, there's a USB jack, and on the front side is a 30-pin header connector. So two rows of 15 pins at 10th inch centers. So it's those kind of posts sticking out the side. So all of the electrical connections have to be made to those little header pins. And the BNC thing we're talking about snaps into that and gives you four BNC connectors, two of which are the two scope channels and two of them are the waveform generator outputs. So the two scope channels you said are with that BNC connector, it's a 30 megahertz scope. So for most ham stuff, if you're doing anything in the audio domain or in the low speed digital domain, that would be perfectly adequate. So that makes it a very very useful scope. And so imagine that the when you think of an oscilloscope, as you know, I'm talking to our listener here. If you think about an oscilloscope, you've got the display and all the knobs. And there's no physical knobs on this. All of the knobs, quote unquote, are all done as images and software on the screen. So you would click buttons or set pull down values for the sweep frequency or the voltage ranges or whatever you're changing on the screen. And I got to say that one thing I love about the software is it's very responsive. So the update on the screen is like really, really fast. So it looks just like a regular piece of instrumentation. So the thing is really quick. So that's any other specs on the scope that are worth noting?
The other important one is that it's 100 megasample per second sample rate.
And that's in total, so 50 megs per channel?
100 per channel.
Oh, 100 per channel. So you can oversample. That's how you can get at least the 30 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of software settings for that.
So one of the other questions I would ask about that is, what is the voltage range on the inputs for the scope?
For the scope, it will read and give values for positive to negative 25 volts, and it's protected to positive to negative 50 volts.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So pretty useful range.
Yeah, and then if you have the BNC probes and you attenuate the BNC probes, you could get a bigger range.
Just by flipping the attenuator on the probe, you mean the 10X?
Yeah.
Switch.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other instrument or the next instrument that pops to mind that's useful is the function generator. So mm-hmm. Could you describe what that thing does?
Yeah, so the function generator is a combination of a function generator, true function generator, and then an arbitrary waveform generator. So you can do a number of set functions. There's even AM and FM modulated signals that you can output. So normal sine, square, and then you can also do custom waveforms too. So
like the simplest example, let's say you're doing an audio circuit and you just want to put a tone through the mm-hmm. circuit, like a 1 kilohertz, 1 volt, signal. Yep. That's an easy thing to set up. If you want to do something more complicated, like describe what some of those other features are, like a modulated signal, or what else can you do?
Yeah, so you can do a modulated signal. You can do a sweep, so starting at like 1 kilohertz to 10 kilohertz. You can play back different audio files, and then you can do a custom one where you draw it or you set the data points. So many number of waveform.
Okay, so here's a sort of a side question. Can you import a SPICE piecewise linear kind of waveform where you have like various data points over time, you know, like voltages over time?
Yeah, you can do, so you can import a CSV file, a text file, a wave file, an MP3 file, or a WMA file.
Okay, so if you can get to it in the form of data, then you can do it. Okay.
Yep.
And there's two channels of that in the 82, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two channels.
And all of these instruments could be running at the same time. So you could be having two different waveforms being generated while you're looking at the signals with the two oscilloscopes.
Yep.
So, you know, when you listen to this as thinking about how you could use it as a, you know, as a ham, and you go to set up your workbench, you're going to want to have a bunch of different pieces of test equipment. You want to have a two-channel scope, be nice to have a function generator, et cetera, et cetera. But instead of buying a bunch of boxes, you get this little puck in software and everything is included in there and it's super tiny. So those are two useful functions. So what else does it, what would be the next most popular feature?
Well, hold on, before we jump off that, you know, one of the things, Caitlin, you probably don't know, but we actually did like a 17-hour episode on oscilloscopes in the very beginning of our show. So, I mean, we've gone over scopes, their uses, why hams care, but function generators really are not something that we have covered in depth. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, the average ham has probably heard of the quote-unquote two-tone test, but why do I want a function generator on my bench?
The most useful thing that I've seen, or that actually I've used it for in school, is just to test if I'm building something, and maybe I'm building it for a specific signal, but I don't want to plug it into that signal yet. You can load that signal into the waveform generator and use it to test what the output should be, with a very controlled test.
Okay. So I can give you an example, actually.
Okay, please do, because I'm lost.
Yeah. So let's say, for example, you're building an audio circuit. So one of the projects, Caitlin, we're working on is a little repeater controller. And so the repeater controller basically is an audio signal path that has a microcontroller that will decode DTMF tones and will generate Morse code and stuff like that. So part of the circuit takes your receiver audio in and goes through a couple of op amps, goes through a digital pot to set the level, goes through a couple of CMOS switches to route the audio, goes into another couple of op amps until it pops out at the other end, and that's used to drive the transmitter. So you've got this audio chain, and when you're designing the circuit, you want to test to see if it's working right. So the thing that I use this for, I take the function generator and I use it to generate a tone. So let's say a 1 volt sine wave at 1 kilohertz. So here's my beautiful little sine wave coming into the first op amp. So the first thing I'm going to do is take the scope probe and I'm going to put it on the output of the op amp to see if it's working. So I'm going to make sure that it's, if I get a sine wave in, I get a sine wave out, and I look at the relative amplitude depending on how much gain I set in that op amp. Then if that looks good, then I'll go to the next stage. And if that looks good, I'll go to the next stage. Well, the next stage is a digital pot. So my microcontroller is sending serial bit streams to the digital pot to set the value of the pot, the volume, if you will, of the receiver. So I'm looking at the output sine wave coming out of the digital pot with the scope that's being generated by the waveform generator while I'm sending commands to the microcontroller to change the pot's level. So I'm using that in this first example, Jeremy, of this to be the source, like Caitlin was saying, be the source of a signal that I'm then tracing through the circuit to make sure the circuit works. The second use I have for it, once I've proved that I can go in one end and come out successfully out the other end, which isn't always true, But, you know, assuming all that works, then what I want to do is I want to see what the frequency response of that circuit is. So I know if I put a 1 kilohertz tone in, I'll get a 1 kilohertz tone out. I just proved that. But now I want to sweep it. So I want to send in a frequency from, let's say, 50 hertz to 3 kilohertz and sweep, let's say, over the course of 5 or 10 seconds, sweep through that range. And if the waveform coming in is flat, in other words, it's a volt at 50 hertz and it's a volt at 1 kilohertz and it's a volt at 3 kilohertz, it's flat, I want to look at the output and see if the output is flat. If the output's not flat, then there's something that's coloring or distorting the audio frequency response of the circuit. So that's the second use for it. The third use for it is, in some cases, I actually want the audio frequency roll off to change. I might want to attenuate PL tones. I might want to attenuate high frequency noise. And I want to make sure that if I generate noise at, let's say, or just a sine wave at those frequencies, that I'm successfully attenuating them through my filter. So, right off the bat, that, you know, there's a bunch of uses for the combination of the function generator and the scope.
Okay. So let me ask a couple more questions about this, just because, again, it's not an instrument that we've talked in great depth about. You know, I have used before, if I was working on some stuff and I needed to simulate, serial data, but to your point, I don't have the thing that is going to actually send the data. And I've written a little Arduino, you know, program to just spew what I'm looking for. Do you have an opportunity to output, serial data for testing as well?
Another one of the tools that you can use is the pattern generator, which lets you do digital data.
Ah. And
yeah, so that is another very useful tool. So as of right now, you can generate counters, pulses, clocks. There's also an option to write in a script a custom pattern. But right now it's not set up to generate a spy signal. In the logic analyzer, you can read and decode a spy signal, or I2C, if you need to decode and see the data. In the protocol analyzer, you can read and write in spy I2C. UART and CAN just got added.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's a whole separate tool.
Now, when we're talking about the decoding, so the protocol analyzer, like you said SPI, I2C, standard serial. I can give an application example with this is, when one of the first standard NMEA output GPSs I ever had, I was connecting it the right way to the application I was using it for, had all the connections right, or at least I thought I did. And I wasn't getting data into the radio the way that I was expecting it to, like connecting it to a D710. And so I was able to use a much more clunky and older protocol analyzer to basically read the serial data that was coming out. And, you know, actually, I had previously purchased a dedicated piece of hardware that all it does is logic analysis and protocol decoding. I've actually had an opportunity or two to use it at work. But of course, that's just a single instrument. You know, if you want to be able to see what data is coming out as far as digital data and have that be decoded into something human readable, this is really a useful tool. Now, are you able to show both like an ASCII value and hex values and binary values and the waveform? Like, are you able to see all those different ways of the data output happening?
On the protocol analyzer, you can see the actual value. So it'll give you the hex or decimal value. But if you wanted to see the waveform, you would open the logic analyzer instead of the protocol analyzer.
I gotcha. And the protocol analyzer, will it also decode down to ASCII?
I don't think so. If that is a heavily requested feature, though, we'd like to hear a form.
When you say decode, you mean like a hex value, something, something, something means
a
start of transmission.
Or an
ASCII character. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, for instance, you know, wanting to be able to see that, you know, data values are coming out. I mean, sometimes it can be easier just to see the human readable version of it than necessarily getting the raw hex out and then having to do another step to convert it.
Yeah, like all the time.
Unless you're a robot.
Useful. Yeah. if you're a protocol droid, you know, maybe that's different.
If only we knew how to get a hold of the product manager for this thing.
Yeah, we'll have to work on that.
Then you could like request features.
What's the most requested feature that you guys don't have?
The most requested feature that we don't have?
Yeah.
That's a good question. That probably changes every couple months. So we release a new version of the software a couple times a year, and most of the changes, new features, are based on what we hear on the forum customers requesting. So like, for example, I guess for the last, 10 years, the most requested feature that we didn't have was a protocol analyzer. So we added
problem solved.
Yeah, exactly. Well, except, it's one of the benefits of software.
Except we just told her they didn't go far enough.
Yeah. Well, you got to request it on the forum.
Yeah, get with it, Jeremy.
So, actually to that point, I know we're kind of interrupting going through the blades and the Swiss Army knife here, but, we talked about earlier that the FPGA is basically software definition of hardware, right? Have you guys, first question.
No, that's not quite true. It's a software configuration, but it's really hardware that's running.
Well, no, I know it's hardware, but technically you are basically designing virtual hardware using software that you send to the FPGA, right?
Yeah. You're telling it how to hook up the hardware.
Yeah. And then what the hardware should do. But the question I have is is firmware still the right word for that? What you're actually uploading to the FPGA?
Well, no, not really.
Okay.
In the Xilinx world, when you create the data that gets squirted into the RAMs in the FPGA, those are called bit streams. So it's, and that's their term. I mean, it's a Xilinx specific term that's become kind of a generic term these days, but they just call it a bit stream. And that's what represents the interconnection scheme of the logic in the FPGA.
Okay. Cause I'm talking about the HDL program, the hardware definition language program that you send to it to configure it.
Well, so what happens is you write your HDL, you write your Verilog or VHDL code, and then you run that through a compiler, which translates that code transforms it into a lower level of logic. And then that logic is mapped into the structures that are available in that particular FPGA. So all of the gate equivalents. So inside the FPGA, it's really an array of lookup tables. There are multiple input gates, and you basically send a little piece of code to every one of those gates to tell it what its logical behavior is. And there's tens of thousands of them in the chip. So the software is really a compiler that transforms the source code in, let's say, Verilog into this internal logic map that gets transformed into the bitstream.
All right, but we're not calling that logic map firmware.
No, because the firmware really is referring to microinstructions, not the interconnect architecture of that specific application.
Well,
otherwise, it'd be confusing because there's FPGAs like the Xilinx Zynq FPGAs that are a combination of programmable logic, traditional FPGA, plus microprocessors like ARM CPUs. And so you would really refer to the code that's going into the memory to run on the ARMs as the firmware, and which is very different from the HDL stuff that gets compiled into the logic.
Gotcha. So the root of my question is whatever that code is that you're using to configure the FPGA. So you've mentioned a few times that you guys have made application updates to the software that runs on the host computer. Have you guys also made changes to the software that is running in the FPGA over time?
I don't believe so. I don't think we have.
Okay, yeah, because I know, sometimes that's a way that manufacturers may add new capabilities and whatnot, and so I was curious about that.
Yeah. Most of the improvements that we've made have been, like, the base oscilloscope functionality is there, the waveform generator functionality is there, and so you can take the data and turn it into a network analyzer using those tools together.
Gotcha. So, going back to the wheel of instruments, we just did the protocol analyzer. What next would you describe?
Well, we kind of briefly covered like the spectrum analyzer and the network analyzer. Those are other ones that commonly get missed. And a big interesting thing to know about waveforms and a helpful tip is that all of the view menus show different tools within other tools. So, for example, in the network analyzer, if you open the view menu, you'll find Nichols and Nyquist plots as well. So more types of plots in all the different tools.
So, Caitlin, you know, we've talked about a network analyzer. Just because I'm ignorant, what is a network analyzer and what would I use that for if I'm tinkering around on a project on my workbench?
Yeah, so the way, I guess, our network analyzer works is that you plug in the oscilloscope and the waveform generator channels, and it will generate a sweep of sine signals from one frequency to another frequency, and you'll see the ratio of that output to the input. So if you have a filter, for example, where it's supposed to cut off the low frequencies, you will see you'll see the amplitude response and you'll see the phase response on the network analyzer.
So, okay, that kind of makes sense. But if I'm building something, what am I actually using that for? I mean, because in amateur radio, you know, we've talked a little bit in the past about using RF spectrum analyzers or RF vector network analyzers to, you know, characterize, say, a filter. You're trying to build a bandpass filter from 7 megahertz to 7.3 megahertz. So what are the types of things that somebody is trying to characterize on their workbench as a student, hobbyist, or whatnot?
Yeah, so when I went to Washington State University and aside for electrical engineering, and in one of our final analog classes, the final project was to make some basic signal analysis circuits for what would be inside of like an AM transmitter and receiver. What we used it for was to see, we have, an envelope detector. We have a bunch of filters, and I had a lot of problems with the bandpass filter. There's also an audio jack, so you can hear the audio that's going in. And so I was not getting the correct modulation that I needed in my bandpass filter. And so I was able to use the network analyzer to characterize the low pass part and the high pass part, and determine which one of my values was incorrect and causing the wrong frequencies to be taken out.
Okay, got you. But still, not in an RF application, but literally talking about base electrical signals that are oscillating, on the wire, if you will.
Yep.
George, did I get that right?
Yeah, I think essentially that's right. That's a good way to put it. Hey, back to your wheel of features, Jeremy.
Well, I was going to jump next to the spectrum analyzer because,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think
jump ahead to something else.
That's kind of a sister application.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the spectrum analyzer.
Yeah. So on the spectrum analyzer, you're able to see what component frequencies are in your signal. So it would be another way, I guess, if you wanted to look at the output and you see you're not hearing something correctly. You see which frequencies are missing, what the amplitude of those frequencies are, but on a different plot. This is not actually a application, I guess, that would be in practice, but a really cool thing that I like to explain in the spectrum analyzer is looking at a square wave, because square wave is made up of many different frequencies of sine waves. So when you put a square wave into the spectrum analyzer, you'll see all those different frequencies and you'll see a huge spike at wherever the square wave actual frequency is. And then you'll see smaller spikes at all of its harmonic frequencies. So it's a neat way to explain square waves.
So yeah, it's a frequency domain instrument rather than a time domain instrument. So it's looking at the 90 degrees separated of the data, but I mean, to be clear, and again, folks who haven't seen this, but really can't appreciate how compact this device is. I'm assuming this is not the kind of thing that I am going to take my favorite, $35 Chinese 5-watt handy talkie, turn it down to 1 watt, and plug it in to try to characterize it. I'm assuming, again, it's not made for RF power.
No.
Unless you want to let the smoke out, right?
Yeah, you're only going to do that one time.
Yes.
Yep.
And just out of curiosity, what's the frequency range for the spectrum analyzer?
The spectrum analyzer will The software will let you go up to 50 megahertz. Obviously, it depends on what input you have. So the BNC adapter versus the just the fly wires. All of the tools that use different channels. So the spectrum analyzer is using the oscilloscope channels, has the same limitations of the scope channels.
Okay. So even though if the software will let you go up to 50 megahertz, I'm assuming that's either aliased or those are like the negative 12 dB tails.
Yeah.
Okay. So really again, 30 megahertz is the operating within the designed predictable parameters. Anything outside of that, mm-hmm. your mileage may vary.
Yep, exactly.
Okay. Now, George, I will return you to the wheel of instruments.
I should return Caitlin to it. What haven't we not talked about yet?
Well, let's see. There is a lot of tools. So another new tool that was added is the impedance analyzer. So if you have a circuit you built and you need to characterize the impedance, you can use the impedance analyzer for that.
Okay, so Caitlin, I want to know, what is the most interesting application that you've seen one of your customers use an analog discovery for?
So one of the ways that people use analog discovery and the reasons why they choose the analog discovery is because it allows you to write custom applications with the different tools and use the tools in conjunction to do automatic testing. And so someone, actually we have a number of customers that have created custom applications for the analog discovery. So for example, there's a, someone wrote an audio analyzer suite for the analog discovery. So they had an application they needed and they wrote a whole other bit of software for it.
So, yeah, I mean, one of the neat things is, you know, in addition to the software that you guys have provided, you mentioned earlier that, that you offer an SDK. So what are some of the languages, that you guys have an SDK available in or that the community has created?
Yeah, so our SDK is written so that you can write your custom applications in C++. And we also had a customer create an SDK for us in Java and some other customers that allow Python. So lots of options.
Ooh, see, that's nice because Python is the new hotness.
Yeah, Python would be very popular. By the way, there's something else that's simpler than the API or SDK software development that I used myself, which is when you set up the Windows, and I had this question for Caitlin earlier this week. I have an application where I want to have the signal generator on the screen and the scope on the screen and the digital IO panel on the screen at the same time. And I want to set the Windows up the way I want it. And I am generating a signal. I'm using one of the digital IO signals to switch the direction of the signal and then out back to the scope. Anyway, once I set up my display with the Windows the way I want it, I can save that setup in a file. So later on when I want to come back and do the same test, I could just open that configuration file and the Windows will appear the way I left them off the last time. So that's really convenient. That's very handy.
But
and
like,
by the way,
it's like organizing your workbench.
Yes. Yeah. Like, for example, the digital IO panel, you can label every one of those switches or buttons or LEDs or whatever you are configuring that instrument for. So, for example, this little thing I'm testing is to exercise a transmitter. So it's keying the push-to-talk signal and then generating a 1 kilohertz audio tone and shoving it into the modulator of the transmitter. And then on the receiver side, on another radio, I'm taking the discriminator audio off and into the scope. So the push-to-talk signal is being controlled by the soft front panel in the waveform tool. So that whole setup is just saved off as a disk file, and I could just set it up by opening that configuration file. So it's very cool. It's a really useful environment.
You know, you just spurred a question. You know, we're talking about all the waveforms and the patterns that we can generate. Is it possible to use this thing as an LED driver, like PWM or I just don't. And I guess I'm asking more because, I mean, for instance, the pattern generator, I think, is where you mentioned earlier. I think I heard you say that that's the one that you could modulate a signal with, and pulse width is a modulation type.
So originally I was talking about the waveform generator where you can do frequency and amplitude modulation. And then the pattern, so the waveform generator is not digital signals. If you just want digital signals, it's the pattern generator. Mm-hmm. You can do a pulse, but there's no built-in pulse width modulation. Okay. That being said, if you're handy with scripts, you could certainly write a script to do it.
Yes. Well, and I guess really the ultimate question is, these outputs, I mean, obviously they're designed to be voltage outputs and not really provide much current. That's why I was ultimately just wondering, because in theory, if you were doing a test where it would be hyper useful to have a visual indicator, such as an LED light up, you know, a physical LED light up. That's why I was kind of wondering is if, you know, could you wire this thing up to actually light an LED?
Yeah, the output logic can output 12 milliamps. So it's not designed to output a lot of current. It would be more advised to use it as like a switch. But there's also I/O in the software where you can get like a virtual LED attached to one of the digital I/O pins. So if you had whatever you wanted to be your visual cue, whatever signal you needed to see, you could attach that to one of the digital I/O and use the virtual LEDs on the screen as a visual cue.
Okay. So, or like you said, you could use this as a triggering instrument and then build like a little minuscule LED driver.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, to drive an external device, all you need is a transistor and, you know, a little MOSFET, and you could just, you can sync hundreds of mils with that. So you can have some gigantic, you know, LED or whatever you want and just hook it up to the transistor and just use the 3-volt logic output to drive that.
Yeah, you know, and that's what I was talking about, building an LED driver. Although, we're going to have a conversation about what you take for granted and what literally wizardry I just heard you say. You just take a transistor. That's another show.
Like you do.
Like as you do, yeah. And I know we're jumping all over. We started to get to the hardware. I do have one more question, because there is one more instrument, and it's kind of related to my last question. It's the power supply. Mm-hmm. And I understand that I would like to very carefully unpack the power supply, because I understand that it can do different things depending on how you have the analog discovery 2 hooked up, and there are multiple channels, and you know, and maybe you can bridge them, maybe not. But if you would walk us through the power supply.
There are two ways to use the power supply. The analog discovery has an auxiliary power supply that you can plug in. So you can plug in a wall supply if you need more current than and more power than USB can supply. So there are different specifications for each way you have it hooked up. So if you are USB powered, for total of both supplies, you can get a maximum of 500 milliwatts of power and then 700 milliamps of current for each supply. So 500 milliwatts total and 700 milliamps for each supply.
All right, so you're saying 500 milliwatts, not 500 milliamps.
Yes.
Okay, and I'm going to pull on this a little bit.
On USB.
Right, because so, you know, the standard USB spec, long before we had things like smartphones that needed high current charging, standard USB spec was, if I'm not mistaken, it was 500 milliamps total current on the bus. So if I am plugging this into a modern USB 3 port, which I think can handle a lot more than that, I don't remember what the value is. Maybe it's up to 3 amps. Mm-hmm. Can it draw more, or is it limited because it says, oh, you have not plugged the external power supply into me, therefore I am going to limit my output to X?
Yeah, so it's limited if you're not on the auxiliary supply.
Okay, so regardless of whether or not your USB port can actually support a lot more current than the standard, if you don't have that external supply plugged in, then you're just stuck with what it is on USB.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, so that's mode one, 500 milliwatts up to, you said, 700 milliamps.
Yeah, for each supply. So the wattage is total. The amperage is for each supply.
Okay.
So then if you have the auxiliary supply plugged in, you can get 2.1 watts, and this is for each supply. And then 700 milliamps of current, again, for each supply.
And that's whether plugged in or not?
That's plugged into the wall, like wall plug-in.
Okay. Is the wall plug-in like a standard 5-volt, like 2-amp deal? Or no?
Yeah, it's 5-volt, 2.5, I think, amps.
Okay. That's actually a lot more than 2.1 watts.
Yeah, well, there's going to be, there's limitations based on, like, the ICs that are doing the signal, like, the front end designs of the power supply. And then there's also the device itself, the Analog Discovery 2, uses some amount of the power as well.
So, and what is the output range for the power supply? The voltage output range.
Oh, the voltage output range. So there's a negative supply and there's a positive supply. So the positive supply can go from 0.5 volts to 5 volts, and then the negative supply can go from negative 0.5 to 5.
Okay, so you can't do what I was suggesting, where you could take both supplies and bridge them together to get double the output.
So the two different supplies are spec'd differently, or it's spec'd differently depending on if you have the auxiliary supply plugged in or the USB power plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have USB power plugged in, the watt limitation is for total. So for both supplies together, like total. And then the auxiliary power spec is for each supply.
Right. So, but I'm saying I could not join the positive from supply A to the negative supply B and get a total of 10 volts out.
If you had the ground placed correctly, yeah, you could.
Okay, because, well, that's the part I'm getting confused on the positive supply and the negative supply. But yeah. That may just be because I don't ever have to do with negative voltage.
The positive supply is positive relative to the Analog Discovery's ground, and then the negative supply is negative relative to the Analog Discovery's ground. So you can do some clever ground placement to get 10 volts if you need to, or 8 volts. There's actually a video about it that I just filmed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So you can, but instead of doing like we would normally do with common ground, or not even common ground reference. I guess that's correct. Where you would run, let's put this in terms I can understand, red to black, and then on the inside and then on the outside, you connect it to whatever device under test. In this case, I'm assuming you would, this is terrible because they're not red, are they? You would connect the positive pin to the positive pin?
Well, the positive supply is red, the wire.
Okay. So on the negative supply, if I want to bridge them, what do I do?
So what matters is where you're ground. I'm trying to pull up. I have the exact circuit so I can describe it most accurately.
All right, then if once you pull that up, I will re-ask the question of, can I combine the power supplies to get either more current out or more voltage?
So the essential question is the ground chassis ground referenced, or is it a floating ground? Is it negative, or is it really ground?
The negative, the ground, or the...
So on the power supply, there's a plus and minus output lead, right?
Yes.
So is the minus reference to circuit ground, or is minus just minus relative to the positive output? It's isolated from ground.
It's minus relative to the Analog Discovery's ground.
Yeah, so it's a single-ended ground. It's not a differential ground. So actually, I have a cool project that I'm going to use this for.
Awesome. Well, tell us about it.
So when we were talking about doing a custom board, Caitlin, like you're talking about some of your customers, some of the universities doing a custom board. I have a custom board in mind that I started designing for our repeater control systems. And it kind of goes back to the earlier example that I mentioned, where we have a control system that has multiple ports. So it's multiple audio channels in and multiple audio channels out and some control interface. So I'm going to make a little test board that has the 30-pin the 30-pin header connector, and you can snap the 82 on one end. And on the other end will be some other connectors and cables that go to the repeater controller. And then I could put my panels up on the screen to do the signal generation and the with the scope to do the frequency sweeps and all that stuff that I mentioned. And when you're talking about the digital I/O lines, I use those to generate logic signals for what we would call the in ham terms, COR and PL decode, the two logic signals that tell the controller that the receiver has received a valid RF carrier and that it should in turn turn on the transmitter. Well, all that stuff will be interfaced between the AD2 and the repeater controller. So what I could do is set all the levels in the repeater controller and sweep it to make sure the frequency response is good. And that extra switching logic, like with little relays and stuff, will all be on this little custom interface board. So bringing everything out to a header is super handy, because in that one dense connector, you've got all the instruments pinned out right there. So plus, once it's done, besides the interactive waveform view and signal generator view, then I could also look at doing some of the scripting like we were talking about to automate that sequence of tests. So I'm pretty excited about actually making that happen. And you can't do that as easily with box instruments. So if I had an old Tektronix oscilloscope and my old Heathkit audio signal generator that has no computer interface, and let's say the logic inputs would be from some other gadget I'd have to build, it'd be a big pile of boxes and cables. And this way I can make the whole thing on one circuit board and the AD2 plugged into it. So it'll be very small and very easy to program.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. So once that gets done, we'll shoot some pictures of that. Maybe we could bring that to Dayton. Hey, by the way, speaking of Dayton, Caitlin.
We'll be there.
Hey, so tell us about your plan. What you're going to do at Dayton?
Hopefully, we'll be in a booth right next to the AM Radio 360 guys. You'll have your demo, of course. I have some demos that I want to bring. I'm hesitant to talk about them because I have not finished them. It's early in the process. Well,
that's
either about them now. That way, you're committed.
Yeah, I was going to say, or it's guaranteed to jinx you. Your choice.
So that means I'll either 100% have it or not at all have it. That's the promise.
Are you going to bring any other stuff to show off?
Yeah, so I always have a backpack full of instrumentation with me. So if there's anyone there that wants to see the Digital Discovery, the OpenScope, I'll have all of them and have computers set up so people can try it out. Probably have a bunch of circuits set up so you can try out the different tools and check them out yourself.
Very cool. Are you going to do any kind of special giveaway or promotional thing for people?
Yes, I'm sure we will.
So it's probably worth our listeners' while to come by and check it out. It's
definitely. We have we've thrown a couple ideas around for giveaways. Usually they're integrated with social media, like Twitter, Facebook. We'll post and then you could come see us. But if you come by and see us, we'll definitely have definitely always have giveaways. And usually we have some sort of other special promotion that you get for being at our booth.
So let's talk about the price and what the different parts are. So if I'm going to go buy the Analog Discovery, what's it cost and what are the accessories that I might want to get with it?
The Analog Discovery itself is $279. And with that, you get the common accessories. So the flywire, the USB cable, a handy box to keep it in. And then there is several accessories, actually a bunch of accessories. The adapter is the BNC adapter, which gives you oscilloscope probes for the waveform generator and the oscilloscope channels, is $19.99. And there's also a breadboard adapter that connects from the 30-pin connector directly to a little breadboard that is also $19.99. And then scope probes, and there are mini grabbers that you can attach to the flywires. So you don't have to disassemble whatever you're working on to test it. You can just grab them, similar to scope probes.
You know, it's funny. I was actually looking at those because I have a set of those for my for the other dedicated logic analyzer and protocol decoder that I have. And those things are insanely useful because the hooks are made perfectly for working on, you know, 0.1 pitch, you know, circuits. They're fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, I've used them. A lot, mostly for, we have some robot demos and for viewing like the motor signals to make sure those are working correctly. So you can just grab the little signals. You don't have to unplug anything.
So if I'm going to buy the basics of what I need the analog discovery. I probably want to get the scope probes and the little interface board. So I'm looking at about $300.
Yeah. Yeah. Just about.
And if you're going to go buy, let's say, the equivalent of instruments off the shelf, you're certainly going to spend more than that. So, you know, to try to get the same functions at $300, you're probably looking at buying some used analog gear. So maybe you find an old oscilloscope for $100 and a function generator for $100 and a power supply for, you know, $50 or something. So you can probably cobble together the equivalent in a bench full of old stuff. So if you want to have something that's very compact and all in one and all software programmable, then this is actually rather competitive. But we were also talking about maybe you guys could put together some kind of special for our listeners. So we don't have the details for that yet, right?
Yep. Yeah, don't have the details yet, but there will definitely be a Ham Radio 360 bundle with some sort of discount for all of you listeners out there for listening to us talk about it.
Very cool. So that'll happen way before Dayton, I hope.
Yes, way before Dayton.
Okay. So maybe the next month or so, we'll have an announcement about what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll definitely give you the information to announce it. We'll announce it on our blog.
Cool.
Okay. Very good. Anything else that we should ask you about this stuff or Digilent before we go?
Well, one thing. So I know we talked about the power limitations and having a power supply that's limited to the plus or minus 5 volts. We also have, as an accessory that's really handy with the analog discovery, I've seen a couple of university customers use, we have these little power bricks that can, you plug them into your USB port on your computer, and then they can output their four choices, 3 volts, 5 volts, 9 volts, or 12 volts. So you can still be out portable with your laptop, but you can get higher voltages than the analog discovery can provide. So it's a nice add-on.
Yeah, George, we during the Christmas episode, Nick introduces the concept of these little breadboard pluggable power supplies. But these are super nice because, I mean, they're in a nice package. They are literally made to clip into the power rails on standard breadboards. So this is these look really awesome and something probably worth picking up to have for the workbench. Do you know, out of curiosity, how much... Oh, I see here. Okay, so the 12-volt one is 100 milliamps. 9-volt is 130 milliamps. 5-volt is 200 milliamps. 3.3-volt is 320 milliamps. Well, so Caitlin, as always, if folks want to know more about Digilent and the Analog Discovery 2, where do they go online?
So for the Analog Discovery 2 specifically, we have a site called analogdiscovery.com. where you can find all the information, the tutorials teaching you about each of the tools, specifications, all that on that website. And then Digilent in general, digilent.com or store.digilentinc.com. And you'll find we have a blog. The best place to ask technical questions if you have a question about an application that you're thinking about doing and you don't know if it would be the right fit or any other technical questions is the forum, which is forum.digilentinc.com. But you can navigate to all that from Digilent.com.
All right. And Digilent is Delta India, Golf India, Lima, Echo, November, Tango. So, Caitlin, I'll throw in, I really want to ask you about the future, but I know that's not a polite thing to do. It's like, tell us about the Analog Discovery 3. No. You're getting some exposure to our community by talking to us. You guys have been all in on wanting to get to Dayton, where you will get more ham radio exposure than you ever thought possible. Out of curiosity, does this hobby hold any interest for you?
Yeah, so I actually, in college, we had a very active ham radio club, and I was the president of the IEEE club, so I was always at all the club events. And I would see all the ham radio guys with radios on their shoulders. And at all the outside events, they'd put up a very impressive radio tower. And so it was always a mild interest of mine. But I was, you know, busy with other things. But now that I have time, I'm off to go get a license soon.
Awesome. So actually, the cool thing is... you're, like I said, you're going to be exposed to more ham radio than you ever wanted. So the good news is you will walk away this summer with a very clear understanding of whether or not you actually want to fulfill on that mild interest.
And part of it is a duty to my family. When I went and got an electrical engineering degree, my family said that we're putting you through this degree so that when the apocalypse comes, you can fix all the radios. So I should probably know how.
Yes.
Well, you've come to the right hobby.
Good.
Well, and
finally
arrived. And the good news is, I mean, you can't tune your radio without some good, you know, instrumentation. I mean, honestly, I'm speculating here. Actually, this is more than speculating. But one of the cool things about having you and other folks like you get exposed to our hobby is, who knows, 3-4 years from now, there may be an RF edition of the, there may be an RF discovery. I know that some other folks who make similar, you know, different domain, but if I'm not mistaken, I think the Red Pataya guys, like after hams, you know, they were exposed to hams that they, I think I read they're releasing like a hams friendly or ham specific version of the Red Pataya. So I don't know, fingers crossed for an RF discovery someday.
I obviously can't promise anything for the future, but I do, a lot of what I do is based on customer feedback and customer interactions I have at places like Hamvention and Maker Faire and other conferences that I go to. And right now I'm actually forming a focus group. If any listeners are interested in reaching out to us on social media, I'm creating a focus group for instrumentation specifically. So,
all right. And if they wanted to do that, where would they do that?
So on any of our social media platforms, the blog, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you can message our account, and then the social media person will give me your contact info, and we'll have an online focus group.
Well, Caitlin, I want to thank you so very much for taking time on a Friday evening to spend with us. We really appreciate you coming on board, helping describe more of what this fantastic tool does. Because again, we often tell people, if you don't have a ton of money, you don't have a ton of space. This is a fantastic exposure to understanding what instrumentation and measurement options there are. And you get an unbelievable wealth of tools in one very simple, small, low power, compact, very portable device. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming having on. Me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back after this.
When you need portable power, check out PowerFilm Solar. PowerFilm's line of foldable panels are perfect for portable ham radio activities, from soda to field day. PowerFilm Solar panels are thin film, light, and flexible. These solar panels are a fraction of the size and weight of conventional rigid panels. Check them out at PowerFilmSolar.com.
So again, we want to thank Caitlin for coming on board and spending time with us to walk us through some of the capabilities of the Analog Discovery 2. Stay tuned, because we are behind the scenes working on a few surprises for listeners that we hope to have live well before Dayton this year.
And we may see something sooner than later on the small test equipment front. So it's very exciting. And I'm looking forward to doing some projects with that stuff. And hopefully you all are too.
All right. So, George, as you mentioned, you know, our next major thing coming up will be covering Baycon. You know, we may have some type of intro together next episode, but I, in theory, will be off the grid living in this cabin for the duration of Winter Field Day. I pray, A, that we make lots of contacts, and B, that I don't come home with either the flu, bronchitis, or a cold.
That sounds like a great goal. I hope you guys have a great time, and I hope everybody's healthy throughout all that. And in the meantime, we'll be freezing out here at 60 degrees in the Bay Area.
Do you even own long pants? Do you have a need for those out there?
Shorts only, shorts and flip flops.
Shorts and I know you're a fan of the short sleeve button down.
Yep, Hawaiian shirt.
Okay. You know.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, as a reminder, once again, this is your next to last opportunity to get Ham Radio Workbench on the Ham Radio 360 feed. Please take a moment and go to your favorite podcast app and search for Ham Radio Workbench. Or if you like to subscribe manually, you can find our feed at hamradioworkbench.com/RSS. If you want to know more about our show, please visit our website at www.hamradioworkbench.com. If you want to get in touch with me and George, we love to get your feedback about our show topics, our show format, our show length. And in fact, actually, we will be looking to do a listener survey in the very near future. But if you want to get that feedback to us, maybe you have a suggestion for a topic for the show. Maybe you are volunteering to come on the show. Maybe you have a project you'd like to share with us. Please, please, please reach out to us via email, workbench@hamradioworkbench.com. On Twitter, you can find us at Ham Workbench, or you can find me, Jeremy, at KF7IJZ.
And I'm at KJ6VU.
And also, we participate in the Ham Radio 360 feed, Facebook forum. George, that tends to be more your beat. I'm more of a Twitter guy, but feel free to keep posting content there.
73s, everybody. Thanks for listening.
73s. We'll talk to you next time.
I think she bailed on us, Jeremy.
Oh, I'm here.
I think she's looking something up.
Yeah, I'm suffering from a, oh my God, I forgot everything I know moment.
What's my name?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
Kelly, it's been great to have you on tonight.
Yes, you understand exactly.
Who are you people? How did I get here?
I'm blanking. And just so you know the extent of how well I know this product, like I used it when I was in college. I've been working with it for 3 years. I had one of the engineers, I was helping him use it. And he was, sorry, this is way a tangent. He was using it and he asked me, oh, what color wire do I use for digital IO 7? And I was like, oh, it's the green one with the white stripe, the third one from the right.
You know your product.
Yeah, except for not right now.
That's okay. Nobody listens to this show. You're fine.
Not at this point. So, Caitlin, what is the digital IO wire color on channel number 7? The worst part is I can't remember the question.
Oh, shoot, I'm being recorded.
Yeah, but this is, again.
You promised to cut this out.
I'll do you one better. I will pause recording. Okay, well, wait, did I? Let's see. I know you can bring all that together to actually answer the question. Because how you explained it was actually really eloquent.
Okay, do you want to record it?
We just did.
No. Well, we'll use that then.
Yeah, again, if you've ever listened to our show, we end up making ourselves sound pretty smart. And I promise you, for every 10 minutes you hear on the show, there's probably about half an hour of bumbling.